ハレークリスナ。So today is the last day of this seminar, and as we announced yesterday, today we'll talk about science. And since it is the last day, and this has been a long seminar, and every day it gets hotter and hotter, and since this is, you know, really dry stuff, so I want to just focus on essential things, and then if you want to have some discussion, we can have that. So I want to talk about background of modern science. So Srila Prabhupada, well known, has said that every living entity, every creature in this creation is endowed with some sort of mystic power. We see that birds, when they go on their migration, they're flying at an altitude of high as 6,000 meters, some of them. That's as high as modern airplanes fly. And they will fly 4,000 kilometers distance. So this is, and they know their way. And how they know their way from the northern part of the world to the South Africa, or in the other hemisphere, the birds are flying from North America to South America. Some birds are coming to India also from far away during different seasons. So how they know the way, scientists can't really explain that. But it has long been an item of great fascination that simple birds are able to do such things. And then we see this very, you know, ugly creature called the bat, which nobody likes when it flies in your room at night to catch insects. It's like a flying rat. It makes everyone disgusted when they see such a thing. But this creature has its own radar. How is it able? Because it's flying around in a very erratic way, apparently, and it's catching insects. How does it know where these insects are? Because bats have very poor eyesight. And these are little mosquitoes and things you can hardly see. And they're flying, you know, these insects are also flying in their own erratic way. So this bat is coming in, and you see them, they're zip, 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 zip. And what they're doing is cleaning up all the insects in the room, and then they fly out. They eat all the insects very quickly, a few seconds, zip, 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 and then they go out. How is that possible? Because they have their own radar system. They make a high-pitched sound, which is higher than human ears can hear. And they have their, you know, big ears. And the sound bounces back from insects. And they can tell then exactly where that insect is and go there and eat it. And then this seabird, you know, the famous seagull, this white bird with the big wings. This bird goes far out over the ocean to catch fish. Where does it get its water from? So the seagull knows how to, just like it says the swan knows how to drink a mixture of milk and water, and take only the milk and leave the water. So a seagull knows how to drink ocean water and leave out the salt. In this way, it's taking fresh water from the ocean. Then wasps. Wasps make paper. The nest of a wasp. You often can see them in bathrooms in India. This is paper. The wasps have collected different material and chewed it together and then form this paper, and they make their little house out of it. Termites, these bugs that eat the wood. So there are some desert termites. And they build kind of like a high-rise apartment dwelling out of the earth. And they build it in such a way that, in accordance to the sun's passing, so when the sun is hot overhead, as little heat as possible is being absorbed by the termite house. But when the sun is sinking down in the evening, then the sun's rays are being absorbed by it, so that the termite house keeps warm at the night, because desert night can be very cold. Deserts can be very hot in the day and very cold at night. So they know how to position their termite houses to take maximum advantage of the sun's heat for the night and to avoid being overheated in the day. On top of that, they make constructions inside which serve as an air conditioning system. This is a little termite bug, you see. Such an engineer, he makes air conditioning. And the octopus and the squid, these are also very, you know, horrible undersea creatures nobody likes to see. Of course, some people like to eat them. But, you know, with the long, squirmy legs. So they have jet propulsion. They have this organ in their bodies so that by which they squirt out water at a very high velocity, and this makes them jet forward. In a second, something is coming to eat them, whoosh, and suddenly they're far away. So they're jet engineers. Birds, some birds built communal nests like apartment buildings. And in this nest building, they're weaving together. They take straws and other things, and they know how to, with just all they have is their beak, and they know how to weave it together, make a very solid construction. Ants keep gardens. Ants know how to sew with their pinchers. They know how to connect things together. And ants keep cows. There's a kind of insect called the ant cow, which in English the proper name is aphid. It's some kind of little insect which yields a liquid which has a lot of nourishment in it, some equivalent to milk for the ants. And so the ants, they keep these other insects, the aphids, in herds, and they control them, you see, and they milk them, and then they take the milk into their place and store. They have dairy for everything. The firefly, it has its own flashlight, electric torch. So these are just a few very well-known examples of the mystic powers that can be seen in all creatures. Srila Prabhupada, even things that we don't take notice of, like trees. Srila Prabhupada pointed out that a tree absorbs food through its feet, the equivalent of its feet. So if you knew a person who could eat with his feet, you know, you put bowl of dal in front of him. He sticks his toes into it and makes the dal disappear, sucks up the dal through his toes. You would be amazed and you would think, this is a great mystic. But the trees, we don't even look at them. The trees are such things that, you know, we see without seeing. Pashati na pashati. We see so many trees every day, but it doesn't register in our mind unless it's hot and we want to get some shade, and or it's raining and we want to get out of the rain, then tree becomes a little more important to us. But there are these living entities standing all around us, and they're able to eat through their feet. And then they have this other process with the leaves called photosynthesis. And they're able to absorb the sun light and turn that into nourishment. And this is why it is said that, from the Vedic point of view, that the fire is inherent within wood. Because wood is produced from this process of photosynthesis. And of course, that term isn't used in the Vedas, but the process is understood, the general process, that the trees are absorbing the sunlight and getting nourishment from that, and that sunlight goes into the wood. And so the wood is fuel for fire. What's happening when you light wood for a fire is one is only bringing out the potential tejas, fiery energy that is already there. So, in everything, when we examine nature closely, we see so much adbhuta, vibhuti, wonderful things, mystic powers. Even in the minerals. After all, what is gunpowder? Gunpowder is just a combination of some very basic mineral substances like saltpeter, this is a type of mineral, and charcoal and a few other things, sulfur. You can combine them, and my father used to do this. He was like an amateur chemist, so he used to show me. He would take these things from their, you know, simple form and combine them and make a little stack of homemade gunpowder on a brick, and then he would hit it with a hammer. And it would be a big boom, and the brick would break into pieces from the force of the explosion. So he used to show me these things. So even within minerals, there is so much potential energy. Yes, to make explosions, but also to heal us, medicines. Medicines are found in minerals as well as in plants. So the whole creation of the Lord is invested with His mystic potencies. And so for a long time in the Western world, during what they call recorded history or Kali Yuga history, men have been observing nature and have been fascinated by these displays of mystic power, and they have wanted to master these powers for themselves. Now, nowadays, you know, in recent times, there's this theory of instinct, that these animals I just mentioned, they do all these things by instinct. Of course, when you try to find out what is this instinct, you come up with a zero. They really don't. It's just a word they use to explain it away, you know. But from Vedic point of view, these creatures, although they are very simple in their consciousness, they have been gifted by the Lord with some powers to help them get along, to help them satisfy their desires within this creation. So science in the West has been long fascinated with these powers and wanted to master them. And so science began science was already there in the ancient Greek world, but that was sort of a proto-science. It was much more just speculation, or or attempts to explain things rather than really to apply these principles. There is some application, but it didn't go very far. But then in the late Middle Ages, then particularly among the monks, they had time on their hands, they were often intellectual men. And so they, as part of their theological speculations, they used to observe nature very carefully. In those days, of course, the idea was to observe nature to better understand the glory of God. So this was all right. So then observing these mystic powers, so these early scientists of the late Middle Ages, they were trying to duplicate some of these things. But in those days, the science was, I think it was this British, I believe he was a monk. I'm sure this comes from a British commentator, one of the very early commentators on science. So he has said that in the beginning, science was, he used this Latin term, experimenta fructifera, which means fruitive experiments. Fructifera from Latin, fruit bringing. So the idea is that they would do experiments with the intention of getting a useful result. So one very prominent field of experimentation in those days was alchemy. They were trying to produce gold from other metals. And so they spent a lot of time trying to combine different metals, mercury and silver, or whatever, copper, to produce gold. It's not known that any of these European alchemists were ever successful. Prabhupada explained there's a Vedic process of producing gold, but this also requires mystic powers. One has to be a yogi so that one can drink mercury. Mercury is deadly poison. But a yogi who has these powers is able to drink liquid mercury. And then he digests the mercury and then he can pass urine on copper. And where his urine touches the copper, gold will be produced. So this is the Vedic alchemy. It's different from the European alchemy was more along the lines of what we understand to be laboratory work. They would have their laboratory and they would be trying to make gold by combining. And also there was a mystical aspect. Magic was sometimes involved. There was a German monk, Black Bertold, his name was, and he's supposed to have invented gunpowder in Europe at least. Of course, before him they knew of gunpowder in India and in China. But apparently maybe taking some information that came along the trade routes, he was experimenting and he made gunpowder, and this advanced the civilization of the world so much, of course. Then they started making guns and bombs. Very progressive. So there was also experiments to sharpen swords, to make swords, the metal of swords, stronger and sharper. So they would take things like, horseradish. It's a type of root. It's very pungent. I don't know if you have this in India, but in Europe, it's a very big item, horseradish. And they would make a kind of soup out of this. And then when making the swords, they would, the red hot sword coming from the fire, they would dip into the horseradish soup. And they would think, because horseradish is very sharp, this might make the blade sharper. So these were experimenta fructifera. It means, this was the kind of innocent stage of of science. They were just trying to make things better, that's all. Experimenting with an immediate application in the practical world. But then they turned their attention to another type of experiment, which was known by the Latin name experimenta lucifera. Now this is a very interesting choice of words. Lucifera means light-giving, but Lucifera, obviously, Lucifer, the devil. And sure, this is actually the real devilish aspect of science was coming out of this. And this was when they're trying to understand nature itself at deeper levels. They were not so much interested in getting some result from such experiments, but just trying to understand how nature works on deeper levels with the intention of gradually gaining power over nature entirely. You see. And so their methodology, you see, experiments, setting up experiments, this involves a mechanical arrangement. The whole process is mechanical. So these experimenta lucifera led to an assumption that the powers of nature are mechanistic. Because some things they were able to duplicate in their experiments, some things happening in nature. Like, for instance, the passing of electricity, creating electricity that passes between two poles like a lightning bolt. So this they did by some mechanical arrangement. So then by speculation, they're concluding that if we are able to do this, reproduce that effect we see in greater nature, then the same principles that we have used here to make that effect must be in the original. You see, if this is mechanical, mechanistic arrangement that we do, to reproduce the effect, then it must be some mechanism that is behind the original. And so this is how that mechanistic outlook of modern science came into being. And this is the prejudice of modern science. This is a, you know, pre-judice, pre-judgment, that everything in nature must have some sort of mechanical or physical in the sense of physics, because physics are just the forces involved in mechanical relationships like pushes and pulls or electrical discharge, things like that. So in everything there, it must come down to physics, exchange of energy in some mechanical system. But obviously, when we consider these examples I gave of creatures and their mystic powers, obviously, there's something much more than just mechanistics involved. Like again, the bird who's flying thousands and thousands of kilometers at such a great height, going from one place to and landing in a distant place with all his fellows. And every year we see those birds coming to that same place, so they know their way. How do they know their way? Are they carrying compasses? You see, do they have some kind of strap-on radar apparatus? Do they have maps? You see? Are they judging from the stars, the direction? We don't attribute that type of intelligence to birds, that they can find their way by looking at the stars. That may be, but generally we don't see that birds have that kind of intelligence. So, again, this comes back to something mystical is involved here. You see? Ants herding their little cows. I mean, is that... There's something... And then they just have this word instinct, you know. Just, oh, instinct. Well, what does instinct mean, Mr. Scientist? Well, then they give a blah, blah, blah to change this, you know, just to put you off the track. It's just a word they use to cover their ignorance. Instinct, Prabhupada said, this means svabhav, one's inner nature, which is a combination of karma, something that is acquired over many, 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 many lifetimes. But ultimately, it means knowledge given by Paramatma within the heart. Prabhupada gave the example of a newborn puppy, you know, born to a mother dog. So newborn, their eyes are not open, they're not even able to walk, they can hardly move, and they're just born, they have no experience of the world, but they know to take food from the mother's breast. The mother is laying there, and they know that they search for the nipple and they drink there, the milk. So again, science, this is instinct, but how is it working? Some blah blah to, you know, brush over the whole thing. But Srila Prabhupada said this is part of, over many, many, many births, the living entity has been born in species where at birth he takes milk from the mother. So this becomes a kind of acquired behavior, but also the ultimate stimulus for the behavior is from Paramatma. Paramatma is giving guidance within the heart. Now seek milk at your mother's breast. So this is an intelligent explanation. But the scientists, they have this dogma of mechanism. And what they can't explain with mechanism, then they just brush away. Instinct or whatever. So, now, one example of how they try to apply, one very, very, with great consequence example, and this was an issue that Srila Prabhupada was, of course, very, very concerned with in his preaching. So, one example of how they apply their mechanistic prejudice is to the question of the origin of life. So, they have this dogma that life, which Prabhupada pointed out, we see life coming out all around us. But life comes from life. Therefore, the title of that book, Life Comes from Life. We never see life coming from non-life. But this has become a scientific dogma as this mechanistic prejudice became practically the only guiding rule of science. You see, I've already explained that science actually came out of religion, the medieval religion. And so in the beginning, science was just a tool of religion, and so then there was no conflict. But then the church, the medieval church, late medieval church, at the time science was coming out, the church was beginning to have its own problems. You see, the church was beginning to be perceived as an oppressive organization. You see, keeping people away from free thought and free behavior. And also stifling people's inquisitiveness, their exploration of the world of knowledge. Therefore, I told you already the story of Galileo, who was saying, you know, he was just, all he did was contradict this ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, who is a pre-Christian. He was not a Christian, but the church had acquired Aristotle as their philosopher, and had, you know, kind of canonized him as the brain of the church, because they had no knowledge themselves. So once this was done, then the church had an interest to preserve this so-called knowledge of Aristotle. and Galileo contradicted it. And so there was friction. So you see this because of the church's own problems, its own problems with the late medieval society. Then science also got, and Galileo is the example. Science got swept up in this politics. So with the Renaissance, this is the period of European history that follows the late Middle Ages, the church could no longer control. They did not have the control that they used to have over what was going on in society. The Renaissance was a big flowering of speculation and art and culture and so on and so forth. And the church had to give way to that. And things became more and more increasingly politicized and divided. And then after the Renaissance came the Reformation, which was when a large section of the formerly Catholic community of Europe split away from the Catholic Church and became Calvinist or Lutheran, or, you know, then there were so many Baptists, there were so many Protestant sects. and all these developments were accompanied by violence and war. The 30 Years' War, the famous 30 Years' War, which devastated whole areas of Europe. I mean, this was war of very, because it was a religious war, one of those, you know, sword and Bible wars. if you do not accept our version of religion, then you die. You know, like the Muslims when they came to India, they were cutting off heads and making towers of heads, you see. So something like that happened in Europe during this Reformation period. And of course, so this led to all this politics. Then science also became politicized. And so science gradually, it broke away from its connection to the church and gradually became anti-church. And this again is over years and years of, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and politics and finger pointing and criticism and bad feelings. So finally, these scientists, they arrived at a point where they felt they had a mission. You know, that knowledge meant to disprove everything the church was preaching. You see, they felt they had this mission, a solemn mission, to expose the church dogma as being all ignorance. And so that meant that science then, their religion became the religion of this mechanism. To explain everything, including the origin of life mechanistically. But this again, it was a gradual process. So it's interesting to point out that the real break, you can say, between science as an institution and religion, the final break, I mean, there were still threads connecting the two. There were still scientists who were serious scientists. They're respected scientists even now, but they were still religious people. And they felt their mission was to try to, through science, defend the Christian faith. But the real final break came in the middle of the 1800s, with Darwin, Charles Darwin. So Darwin was a man who started off, he was the son of a minister himself. So he started off in his young years as also being a Christian, at least in name only a Christian, and having some, you know, conventional respect for the Bible. But as he pursued his investigation into the origins of the species of life, and then his speculations led him to an almost completely atheistic conclusion. So by the end of his life, Darwin was a very staunch, we should say, at least agnostic. Agnostic means a person who will not go as far as to say, I am convinced that there is no God, but he will say, God has not been proven to me. And this is a way of saying that God isn't very important. You see. All right, there may be a God, but he can't be proven. And in any case, with our science, with our materialistic methods, we are progressing. Human life is advancing. This is what's important. We don't need that God. So this became his attitude. So it's interesting that before Darwin began his investigations in the 1830s, and he wrote his book, famous book, The Origin of the Species, in the 1850s. So it's midway in this 19th century. But this is when this split really started to happen. So before 1850, the idea of spontaneous generation of life, that means that life could come out of, you know, you just throw some ingredients together, or in nature some ingredients somehow come together and then life pops out. This was considered totally unscientific. You see, by the investigations of science itself, their experiments, you've heard of Louis Pasteur, the famous French scientist. This had been pretty much clearly demonstrated, and it was accepted as a fact that life cannot just arise spontaneously out of matter. But after Darwin, although there was no proof that life, the proof was the same, the proof could not be controverted, but it had to be the belief, you see? Because Darwin, everyone was celebrating, the atheistic people were celebrating that Darwin has done it. Darwin has removed the need for God in creation. This Friedrich Engels was together with Karl Marx, was the founder Acharya of communism. You see, he and Marx together, they were really excited when this book of Darwin came out. They were, you know, practically dancing for joy, because that was the last. You see, they were already atheists, but they had this problem. Creation. How could there be creation without God? They already had conceived of the, it's called, they were in the line, this so-called sampradaya, of left Hegelians. There was a philosopher, George Hegel. And he started this whole process. And then there were two wings of left Hegelians. So before Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, there was one Feuerbach. And he was openly saying, we have to replace Christianity with humanism. We have to make a man-centered religion. Kick out God and put man in his place. And then society will become just and free. So you see, the concern of the left Hegelians, it was a social concern. It was socially motivated atheism. But still there was this scientific hang-up. You see, that the world, how did it start? And they really didn't have a clear explanation. And of course, the church doctrine of Genesis was there. And everyone was still believing in it. And then at that crucial moment, because they were just so enthusiastic, we have to kick out God and we have to put man in the place. Then at that crucial moment, Darwin, who was not involved in any of the social issues, he was coming in from a different direction, just science, biology. He published his book, and all these social atheists, they were practically dancing in the streets. Now we have it. We can completely remove God from all of human intellectual life. No more need for God. So this is what I mean. That's that final break. And then, of course, it was very controversial, the publication of Darwin's Origin of the Species. And out of this controversy, there came the strong preachers. Darwin himself was a kind of a quiet man. He just liked to do research and wrote his few books. And otherwise, he was living out in the English countryside and didn't like to get involved in these countries. But there were others, like a German, Ernst Haeckel, and then there was Sir Thomas Huxley in England, and others. Sir Thomas Huxley was called Darwin's Bulldog. And Ernst Haeckel was the one who conceived of this, what's called the recapitulation of the species. In the, when the child, the body of the child is being formed in the womb. You probably were taught this in school, that they say that, it goes through the different stages of evolution within the womb. There's a point where the fetus or embryo, I forget how you apply these terms, but anyway, the unborn child is resembling a fish, and then it has a tail and this and that. And Haeckel was the one who conceived of all this. He called it the recapitulation, that this is a proof of evolution. Because within the womb, the embryo is going through all the stages. And he drew diagrams to illustrate this, and these diagrams went all over the world and were put in school books. And what you learned in your recent education is based on these diagrams. But actually, these diagrams are bogus. This Ernst Haeckel, he was a preacher of Darwinism, and he wasn't afraid to lie and to present things inaccurately, just to hypnotize people to accept the theory of evolution. So anyway, this is all beginning, of course. This evolutionary process is beginning with the spontaneous appearance of life out of chemicals. Which, as I said, ironically, before Darwin, it had already been established that this is unscientific. But after Darwin, now they had to believe in this. They still couldn't find any proof in it. But now it's important to believe in it, because we have to be staunch Darwinists. And so this is the beginning of a scientific, or say so-called scientific religion, where science started to become a faith that saw its mission to totally replace Christianity, not just to disprove Christianity, which was, a concern of science even before, disprove the wrong dogmas of Christianity. To perhaps many scientists were thinking, we have to modernize Christianity. They were themselves still some sort of Christian, but we have to bring Christianity up to date. But now, science felt it had the mission to destroy Christianity and replace it. And so along with this, then you see, then these currents of thought, like the communism, merged with scientism, and you get this scientific socialism, the great experiment, the great social experiment, which was seen in the Soviet Union and other countries, which resulted in the death of many, many millions of people. Because it was a big experiment. Total materialism means it's just matter anyway. So just like in the laboratory, many millions of microbes may be killed for the advancement of knowledge, so we can also kill many millions of people to advance knowledge and progress and so on and so forth. So you can see, when it achieved the proportions of religious faith, this is a demoniac faith. This is demonism. So I just want to talk about a little bit about this idea that life comes from matter. Because this was one of the issues that Srila Prabhupada really, like this life comes from life, is a book that is recounting 11 morning walks. Prabhupada was speaking on this issue for 11 consecutive mornings with His Holiness Bhakti Srup Damodar Maharaj at that time, Srup Damodar Das Brahmachari. So this was an issue that was very important to Srila Prabhupada. So in our present day, there is one advocate of evolution named Richard Dawkins. He's a British scientist. And he published a book in which he is presenting the scenario how life came out of matter. And it's a typical scenario. Everyone knows this, of the primordial sea being heated from a lot of sunlight, and also the earth itself was very hot, having not so long before popped out of the sun. So the sea was very hot, and there were volcanoes exploding, and so a lot of minerals in the air falling into the sea, and lightning flashing, and all kinds of things happening. And so out of this mineral-rich sea bubbling away, then complex chemicals were being formed, and these chemicals, then they combined to form proteins and longer chains of molecules. And then, one wonderful day, one of these molecules found a way to reproduce itself. You see, one of these very long molecules was able to divide into another identical molecule, and this was the beginning of life. Now, in Dawkins' book, this, as I said, he's living now, and so this book he wrote will be quite recent. Before, in the introduction, before he describes this whole scenario, he does write that the reader should approach this book as they approach a work of science fiction. These rascals are very clever in doing this, because they know that later on they may be called to account. Because you see, this is the problem with science, that it's always changing. You see, science is supposed to be a body of knowledge, but it's not really. Because everything that is established now in science as knowledge could tomorrow be completely overturned. This is, I mentioned earlier a philosopher named Karl Popper, who, he's a very interesting philosopher when it comes to analyzing science, that he pointed this out, that you can't really call what is established in science as fact, as real knowledge. Because whatever has been established in the future, maybe, in fact, what he says is you can pretty much count on it. At some point in the future, any theory that is now accepted as factual in science will be disproved. As science, you know, and they call this advancement, but it's not really advancement. It's like this Buddhist theory of ever-changing equilibrium. It's just always changing. You know, it's not really advancing. So, you know, the more intelligent scientists, especially those who are writing these books that lean into philosophy, they're aware of this. So they have to put in their book these key points that they'll be able to point to later on. If someone says, "Oh, you wrote a book full of nonsense." No, no, I said that this book may just be science fiction. You know, It's always, they always have to have an escape. So this is also pointing out one of the major, you can say, major lack of foundations. We could say major foundation, but it would be wrong. It's a lack of foundation. That nothing is really established in science. And so what is it then? It's really just founded on speculation. And they have some evidence that they use to back up their speculation, but the thing is that this evidence, it's never complete evidence for anything. So it can be interpreted in different ways by different speculations, and that's the thing about science. That you have something is observed in the world, and one scientist thinks it's happening because of this, and another scientist thinks it's happening because of something else, two different theories or more than two different theories. And then in time, one theory becomes prominent somehow or other. And that's not really on the basis of factual evidence. A very good example is the theory of relativity of Einstein. You see, Einstein's theory did not come into prominence because it was proved one fine day. It just became fashionable. And the proof that was offered by one, what was his name? Eddington, I believe, a British scientist. He was taking something Einstein said about, the bending of starlight near the sun by the gravitational pull of the sun. So he thought during an eclipse of the sun in 1919 that he would be able to measure this and thus demonstrate that Einstein's theory is a fact. So he went down to Africa and he set up an observatory because that was the best place to see this eclipse of the sun. And then he came, and then he announced, we have the clear evidence. This was in the year, 1920. We have clear evidence that establishes Einstein's theory as fact. But actually later, this all caught fire in the newspapers and got spread all over the world, and everyone was, wow, far out. And no one could understand what Einstein's relativity theory was. They read about it and everyone is like, what does it mean? But anyway, it must be true. Because science says it's true. And so, there was this like overnight revolution in people's thinking. Then later on, other scientists were able to get a hold of this Sir Arthur Eddington's observations of this eclipse, and they found out that this doesn't establish relativity at all. But then it was too late, you see. It had already caught on. The public was accepting it. Relativity theory was big, like some Hollywood star or something, some Hollywood movie. It had just captured everyone's fascination, even though no one understood what it was. They asked they asked Einstein, the reporters went to Einstein and said, could you explain your theory to us in such a way that people can understand it? And Einstein said, I don't think that more than 10 people in this world could understand, more than 12 people, he said, yes, I don't think more than 12 people on the face of this planet are able to understand my theory. And so this was reported in the news. And then the other one, Eddington, who supposedly proved relativity. And the reporters went to him about Einstein's statement. Albert Einstein says he doesn't think more than 12 people in the world can understand the theory of relativity. And Eddington said, I wonder who the other 10 are. Meaning that only me and Einstein understand. But in spite of that, no one being able to understand it. It had become overnight the thing. You see? And relativity is still not absolutely proven. It's been found to be useful. But actually, you see, the relativity theory, to get into the history, it's not really a new theory. There were others before Einstein, long before Einstein, even goes back way, way back. There were others who had very similar ideas. And if these ideas are useful, if some use can be found in them, you know, practical use in scientific experiments or in technology, then they get approval. You see, they are considered to be more or less factual. So this is what has happened. It's actually an old idea, relativity, which it just... even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wrote a book called Relative Worlds. It's even there in the Vedas, relative levels of time. You see, what is an eye blink for Lord Brahma here on earth is many ages long. So just understanding that time moves relative according to different perceptions or different levels of consciousness. Different states within this universe. So, anyway, in the same way as relativity caught on, so this idea that life must spontaneously arise from matter has also caught on since Darwin. Although there is no proof for it, and as I said, before Darwin, if someone would say this, the scientists would all laugh at him, like, you're a fool. You see, now it's, well, in order for evolution to work, we must believe in this. So in 1953, there was an experiment done by a man named Stanley Miller in America, which has become another one of those things, you know, just accepted all over the world. You see, that this is, people think that this proves that this chemical soup theory, primordial sea out of which life appeared theory, this proves that it could have happened. So what actually did happen? Stanley Miller, he made a vessel, he had a vessel of glass, and he put in water, and he put in different minerals of the type that scientists speculated would be in that primordial sea. And he warmed up the sea as they think it was warm. And then he flashed electricity through it, as they think there was lightning flashing in it. And he kept that experiment going for some time. And lo and behold, after a while, he detected that some amino acids had formed in this vessel. And so with that, this is showing it could have happened. Now there's a few problems here. One problem is, yes, amino acid is, as they say, it's a building block of life. Now amino acid is not life. It's a building block of life. And there are 20 amino acids that are involved in living organisms. 20 amino acids, very specialized chemicals. Now, Mr. Miller's experiment had managed to generate 4 of the 20. So this is not enough. You know, even if he had generated all 20, that would have not have been life. That would have just been the building blocks necessary. So, even if he had generated all 20, it still wouldn't have proven that life comes from matter. But he only managed to generate 4. And those 4, he had to remove them very quickly. He was always observing his chemical soup, and when they appeared, then he removed them. Because the process, the ongoing experiment, would have caused them to disintegrate very quickly. So he removed them from the primordial sea very quickly so that he could show them, see, these formed in my experiment. See, now if he had just, you know, the scientists do not envision at that time, 400 million years ago or whenever it was, 600 million years ago, at the shore of this primordial sea, that there was a scientist waiting with a glass in his hand. Okay, let's take them out.
right now.
So that sea would have gone on bubbling away, and actually, according to Miller's experiment, what would have happened, that any amino acids that might have formed would have quickly disintegrated. So actually his experiment proved nothing at all. It may have been that four amino acids formed, but that was only temporary formation. So, but you see, they don't tell you that. What they trumpet throughout the world is that this experiment has shown that it could have happened, that life could have come out of the primordial soup. So, you see, but after the formation of amino acids, then the chemical constructions of life just become more and more and more and more complicated. There, in order to, for a gene, you know, the gene is the very elemental aspect of a living cell, where reproduction, the reproduction of that cellular entity, is made possible from within the gene. Excuse me. So, and remember, life means that at some point, according to them, some very complicated combination of chemicals, it divided. It was able to reproduce itself. So that would indicate, by all evidence, that there must have been a gene, you know, genes in this primordial entity. Because this is the way that these living entities produce. The gene has to be there. From the word gene you get genetic material. So that for genes to work, there has to be these very, 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 very complex molecules called histones. And there are five types of histones that have to be there in order for a gene to do its work. Now, the simplest of these histones, because they're of different levels of complexity. So take the simplest one. It is so complex that the chance that it could have been formed by just some, you know, random bubbling of a chemical soup is 20 to the 100th power. The way you visualize this number is the number 20, and then above, 100 above it. So this 20 to the 100th power is a number that's bigger, according to modern scientific calculation. It's a bigger number than the number of atoms in all the stars and galaxies that can be seen at present through telescopes. So the chance of one of these histones appearing, you know, out of just random bubbling is one against a number greater than the number of atoms in the visible universe. And all scientists can say, well, there were millions and millions of years for this bubbling to go on. So, and it must have happened. So therefore it happened. And then you have, for example, another problem. You have this... the DNA strand. So the DNA is the what they call the basic code of life. And DNA, this code, then, you know, it is copied. When a cell divides, it is copied into the new cell. And so scientists, they consider this to be very, very important process. So DNA is incredibly complex. And the other thing is that DNA will not work unless there are the proteins associated, you know, that function with the DNA in order for the copying to go on. So proteins are also very, very complex. And the next problem is that the proteins will not work unless there's the DNA. So you can't have one without the other. So then, the problem is, if everything just arised out of, you know, bubbling, gradually, you know, something forming, and, you know, and then something else forming and coming together, then which came first, DNA or protein? Because protein would be useless without DNA. DNA would be useless without protein. These are two different things. And so the best answer they can give is, well, they happen simultaneously. Simultaneously out of this soup. Protein appeared and DNA, exactly at the same moment. And then they came together and started there. Then the dividing started. So you might as well just believe in Krishna then. It's easier to believe in Krishna than something like this. You see, the chances of one of these things happening is already so astronomical that it's inconceivable. But they have to say two such events happened at exactly the same time, in exactly the same place. You know, because they had to, it couldn't have been, you know, we might think of there's a whole, because they say the whole earth was covered by sea at that time. Right? So maybe, you know, on this side of the earth, the protein is formed. And on that side of the earth, the DNA formed. All right, even simultaneously. But no, they had to have formed at the same place, at the same time. So as I say, it's easier just to believe in Krishna. You know? And another thing is that this theory of evolution, Darwin's theory of evolution, it became, Darwin wrote his book and it became popular and all of that became established before they knew anything about these things. See, this is another absurdity. There was no knowledge of life at the cellular level. So it's simply because Darwinism became established already and became the scientific new faith, new religion. And unless, you know, you belong to this faith, you cannot be a scientist. Just like in ISKCON, unless you're a Brahmana, you cannot be a Pujari. So it's, unless, you know, you believe in evolution, unless you're initiated into this cultic belief, then you cannot be accepted as a, you know, serious, at least within the life scientist, biologist, or any of that. So therefore, when they did discover the cell and all the workings within the cell, then they had this to apply this faith to it. But this just stretches the scientific faith beyond the limit of absurdity. Because a cell, and you can read this in many accounts, I mean, I've read this so many times in different places, different books and magazines, when they start to talk about the complexity of one living cell, they always come to this comparison that a cell, when seen under a microscope, it's like looking at a whole planet from a telescope. You see, through a telescope. That it is so complex, it is like a planet. There are so many things happening at so many levels. And you see, the complex, they've only touched the surface of the complexity. What they know of what's going on in a cell is only very little. They do know that on deeper levels, there is much more happening, but they don't know what it is yet. And they're, you know, steadily trying to find out more and more. But it's like, you know, trying to, it's like now, they're trying to understand what's happening on Mars. You see, and they're always being baffled at every stage. Because it's a whole planet. It's so complex. So, you know, they've had to marry this new knowledge of the complexity of cells to this old theory, which has become dogma now, of evolution. And it just doesn't work. And actually, on all fronts, the theory of evolution is under grave challenge. The fossil theories, the fossil evidence doesn't support it. So many things are out of harmony with the theory of evolution. So it turns out to be a belief. A belief that it's in something that cannot be demonstrated today. These things that they say happened millions of years ago, they can't show them happening now. So obviously it's, you know, this was their complaint against religion, against the Christian religion. You say the world was created in 7 days by a God, but you can't show us that. You can't show us that God. You can't show us how He's creating. So we reject it as unscientific. But they've come to the same point. They have their theory of evolution and spontaneous appearance of life out of dead matter. They can't show this, but you must believe it. If you don't believe it, then you're a fool, or worse, you're a religious person. That's even worse than being a fool. So, one last comment. It's this development of science, where it has reached this very absurd stage. It goes along with, I've indicated already a little bit, but what was happening in European culture as a whole, as Christianity was getting weaker historically, then what was getting stronger? Materialism, and materialism means attachment. So you see, this science is part and parcel of strong, strong, strong attachment to the bodily conception of life, and to the idea, you know, to the conception of life as being only for sense gratification. So on an ethical level, we would say there was this attachment increasing as Christianity, because Christianity in the olden days, from the time of Christ up to the end of the Middle Ages, was the whole doctrine was it had spread. You see, it had spread, become very successful on the preaching that the world is going to end very soon. The initial idea of this was that the initial doctrine of this, it's called millenarianism, that the world will end soon. So the initial doctrine was that those who lived at the same, that generation who lived on the earth at the same time as Jesus Christ, before that generation had died off, the world would end. So it was on that basis that the early Christians were going everywhere and preaching, you must accept Christianity because the world is going to end very soon. And this is how it caught on. Then, of course, you know, time passed and the world didn't end. So then they came up with a new date within 100 years after Jesus' crucifixion. So that 100 AD came and went. So then the church decided, oh, we forgot 10. It became 1000 AD. And that came and went. And this was the cause of the Crusades, because then the question was, why didn't Christ come? You see, the year 1000 came and went. It is said that 999 AD, midnight, you see, the last day, midnight, Rome was flooded with pilgrims from all over Europe, and they were all attending the midnight mass, which was personally performed by Pope Sylvester II. And some people were dying of heart attacks, because it was midnight, now the world will end. Well, the world ended for them. They dropped dead out of anxiety. You know, so then the mass was done, nothing happened. They were really expecting Christ is going to come, and He didn't come. So then a few years later, Pope Urban, he came to the conclusion that Jesus didn't come because the Muslims have conquered Jerusalem. The Muslims had taken over Jerusalem, because Christ would come to Jerusalem. But how can he come there if those dirty Muslims are there? So then that's why the Christians, you know, they made those several crusades down to kill all the Muslims and all the non-Christians, Muslims and Jews, whoever was there when considered not fit to welcome Jesus. Kill them. And they set up their monasteries there and, you know, waited. The Knights Templars, the famous, now they're considered an occult group, but they were the Knights of the Temple of Jerusalem. And they were like, you know, special forces monks, you know. Big men who were monks but who could use weapons very expertly. And they just stayed there waiting for Jesus. You see? Now we've conquered Jerusalem. We drove the Muslims out. Jesus, where are you? And he never came. So, I've kind of forgotten the point I was making. But anyway, this is describing how Christianity in time became weak because of these type of promises they were making that never fulfilled. And so people became more and more skeptical. And also because of, yes, it was very rigid, burning people at the stake and so on and so forth. So, this is, yes, anyway, yeah, I remember my point now. My point was, is that you can imagine a religion that was gaining its followers, preaching on the preaching that the world is going to end. So it didn't see much future in the world, you see. And there was not really much reason to become too much attached to this world. In fact, in that, again, 999 AD, December 31st, all over Europe, farmers let their animals go. You see, they stopped, you know, caring for their farms. People stopped charging for goods in their shops. Why? You know, what's the use of making money, because the world's going to end. So this was always hanging over Christianity in those days. The world's going to end. We're all going to, you know, Jesus will come. We'll all be judged. So there's no point in getting too attached to this place. But after the world didn't end so many times, and you see, there were also, I have somewhere a list of all the dates when the world was going to end. You know, coming up right up to 1999. You remember that? Even in ISKCON, everyone. You know, not everyone, but many devotees were talking about, you know, we have to save grains and get ready. And another. I mean, when you see this date, I mean, there was at least 25 times in history when people were saving grains and going to the tops of mountains and praying. And nothing happened. But of course, there'll always be someone to say, but that doesn't mean it won't happen the next time. Yes, all right. So, but anyway, gradually for most people, they stopped taking this seriously. And so here we are in the world, and it doesn't seem like it's going to end. So then what? So this was simultaneous with the rise of science and the rise of, you know, Renaissance humanism and all these things. And so then the human attention became more focused on this material world. So this modern science is very much a product of that trend. And so it is what I call attachment science, and that's what's wrong with it. Because this science has a bias, it has a built-in gyroscope, you see, a built-in direction finder to always try to prove that you are this body. And life is just meant for sense gratification. Now, science doesn't have to be used in that way. Prabhupada was very happy with that book that Srup Damodar Prabhu wrote. You remember the title? The Science of Krishna Consciousness, something like that. Scientific Basis of Krishna Consciousness. So, in that book, he's just arguing that Krishna is the greatest scientist. So science, which is, you know, just some... it's just some incomplete evidence about the world around us. That's all it can ever be. Some evidence that can be used in, as I say, it's following the lead of the of the animals and of nature. They're already better scientists than we are. And they're endowed with mystic powers by the Lord. So science can just as well be used to establish this Krishna conscious view of the world. But it's just that its appearance in history coincides, in Western history, coincides with this increasing attachment to the material conception of life, the bodily conception of life. And that's what's really wrong with science. It has this bias to be pro-materialism and anti-spiritualism. All right. As I said, I wanted to keep things rather simple. And already it's 11:30, huh? So any questions? Yes.
Maharaj, when you speak about the Advent theory, about these things, there's some common questions students ask. So should I ask a few questions?
Yeah.
Just they ask about this funny question about overpopulation, humans are increasing, you know, this, how you explain human form is increasing, overpopulation.
In relationship to what?
In relationship to Darwin theory. We don't accept Darwin theory, but you see,
Well, I've heard this question as also it's a kind of really, you know, dull-headed way of challenging reincarnation. This is the way I've never heard it asked that way. That if you don't believe in Darwin's theory, then how can you explain overpopulation? That's really stupid. I mean, that's not. They should ask that to their own authorities rather than to us. Because one thing is that, anyway, overpopulation of the world is a big myth anyway. And that is admitted. I have a book on my computer that is explaining that. That this was, this was just a period in the 1950s when I remember when I was in school, a boy in school, they used to talk about the population bomb and all this stuff, and you know, they have also these dates. Within 20 years, life, unless something is done, you know, life is going to become very, very hard for us because there'll be too many people. So that 20 years has come and gone, and everything's still. So actually, the evidence really proves what Prabhupada said, that the earth can support many, many more times the present population of the world. So this was just some panic. You see, the real problem with this so-called overpopulation is just capitalism. That you have a country like the United States, which has 6% of the population, which is exploiting 90% of the resources of the world. So this is what, you know, there's these rich countries, which they make this propaganda because they're scared of losing their grip on the world facilities. So then they make this propaganda, birth control, you know, there should be birth control and abortion and all this thing. Because they would like to see the population stabilized so that the present balance will not be changed, and then they can maintain their economic position, their economic prominence in the world. See, now they've, you know, now these rich Western countries are actually fearing the results of their propaganda for birth control and abortion, because their population is dropping. You see, like I know, because I stayed in Germany for years, and the Germans are really worried about it because, you know, they're very proud people. But the number of Germans in Germany is decreasing, and then people are coming from Turkey and Yugoslavia and all these, you know, low-class places and staying in Germany, and their population is growing. They're becoming more than the Germans. And so, you know, these rich countries, their population is decreasing, and they look at the world and they see China and India, you know, with such big population, and they can understand what it means in a few decades. These countries might become the prominent countries in the world, the powerful countries, because they have more people than we do. You see, so but they're crippled by their, you know, they have so much drunk the poison of materialism and atheism that they can't just vomit it up and say, yeah, we were wrong about this. Now we should have more population. Everyone should produce children. Have very nice family. Like you see that their whole civilization has come to a point where people don't want to have families anymore. You know, because it's too, they're too spoiled. You know, family means work. Family means it, even family. You know, it's interesting how in Vedic life, Vedic conception, family life, well, that's the ashram for sense gratification. But in the West, to be a good, you know, grihastha in their conception, that's real austere. That's a great austerity. You see, rather you just be a total nonsense, you know, and just have sex with anybody and everybody, male or female, doesn't matter. And birth control and abortion and that's what they, you know, that's what their materialism has brought them to. And they can't just, you know, now turn 180 degrees in another direction, because people, they have produced this. This is Varnasankara. They have produced generation of people who want to live this way, who want to live. They expect in many European countries, the Western European countries like Sweden, Germany, England. They expect now that the state will take care of them, that they just be hippies, more or less. And they should get a free apartment, and they should get money every month, enough to eat, enough for a little marijuana, wine, and you know, they should listen, just sit in their apartment, have party all day, listen to music, and do nothing. And yeah, let the Turks work, let the Yugos work, and we'll just sit and enjoy. So this is really, you know, in this punk generation, their slogan is no future. It's really a fact there. There's no future to such type of social order. So anyway, this population is just a myth, overpopulation. It's just a capitalist myth, a scare tactic, and now they're reaping the results of it. So what this has to do with evolution, I mean, I don't even understand, I mean, hypothetically, what the connection, or why they would ask this question.
No, generally they get confused, because we say that there is 84 legs of species, and they are souls. So then they say, how did...
Yeah, but there's unlimited souls, so that's the answer. You know. This is the question I've heard against reincarnation, and this is a typical Shudra attempt to be intellectual. I've heard this many times. It's just stupid.
And then they ask about this genetic, you know, cloning and all these things.
Yeah, Prabhupada said life, you can even see this in this flatworm that you cut in half, and then both halves are alive. So Prabhupada said at a certain level of consciousness, the spirit soul is just taking advantage. There are certain forms of life that, you know, they're waiting to just to enter if something like that happens. So cloning is the same sort of thing. What cloning will turn out to be, that's another thing about science. You know, they get all excited about things that they only very little understand. And then they, you know, like, you know, and they exploded the first atom bomb. This is really bizarre. In New Mexico in 1945, summer of 45, this Trinity test, they called it. It was the very first atom bomb. So all the big scientists were there, Oppenheimer and Enrico Fermi and Edward Teller, this big nuclear scientist. They had the bomb on the tower, and it was ticking down, you know. And so Enrico Fermi, he took bets. He said, what do you think will happen? How many think that this bomb will ignite the Earth's atmosphere and destroy the whole planet? And some were saying, well, yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. Okay, and so then he took money for that. They made a bet, you know? How many think the bomb will not blow up at all? And some betted on that. And some betted on, you know, so it explosions this powerful or that powerful. So they had no idea what was going to happen when they pressed the button to blow up that bomb. And some of them were actually thinking it might set the oxygen in the atmosphere on fire, and the fire will spread all over the world, consume all the oxygen, and everyone will die. But press the button and find out what happens. This is science. So now there's this cloning, and they don't know what's, you know, they're trying to stop the cloning of human beings. But they're already experimenting on this in different places, secretly or semi-secretly. And what this is going to bring, what new form of human life, that we will see. But this is science. I mean, it's really, you know, those mad scientist movies are quite accurate. They are madmen. Because they're gambling. You know, they're gambling with nature, with the powers of nature. They don't know what's going to happen. That there's all this pollution. You know, like when they started to promote the automobile and the first cars were being manufactured, the argument they gave was that now you're using horses, and horses pass stool everywhere, creating pollution. So automobiles are clean. Take the automobile. Now it's the automobiles that are causing much worse pollution than the horses ever did. You see, they can't see in the future. They just... Therefore, Prabhupada said they're like children. Foolish children. Yes?
Guru Maharaj, can you explain this reductionism on the basis of the facts? And I find in your books you just define this factual actually comes from the Latin facio, to make or do.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that I find. And the facts are therefore practical.
Yes, so our perception of the world, how we understand the world, is a fact. I mean, it's something made by our organic senses. Not that it's made out of nothing, but what we're perceiving of the world through the senses, everyone understands, is not the same as what's really out there. For example, there are sounds out there that we can't hear. And there are spectrums of light out there that we can't see. So what we're hearing and seeing, that is a fact in the sense of facta, something made. It's made by our organic senses. And because it is made in time by our senses, so we are always separated in time from the actual reality of the thing out there. By the time we see something, it is that thing is already changed. You see? Just like the sun. They say the sun is so far away that it takes 8 minutes for the light to reach our eyes. So when we look at the sun, we are seeing the sun always 8 minutes old. We're not seeing the sun as it is in the present moment. And even things that are close to us, there is some little time lag. You see? Even if it's just a millisecond. So this is phenomena. This is the explanation of phenomena. This is the phenomenal world. That it isn't really there. I mean, something is there, but what we're seeing isn't really there. You see, it's already changed. It's changing so fast that by the time we take note of it, what we're taking note of has already passed. So this is the meaning of phenomena. This is what the word phenomena means. And noumenal means that which, you know, noumenous phenomena, the opposite in philosophy. The noumenous realm is that which is eternal. It's not passing away with time. Yes, so reductionism is the attempt to reduce. This goes hand in hand with this mechanism I was saying. Science is mechanistic. And so mechanistic, what this means is that everything that we're aware of in the world, the scientific theories are trying to reduce, to mechanism. You see? Analyze. The word analyze means to take apart and to look at it in its separate components. So they think their whole process is to try to analyze or take apart the phenomena of nature and come to some very simple mechanistic relationships of some, you know, very elemental ingredients. And then they think from this that everything will be able to be explained. But again, all of this is based on our sense perception, the facts of sense perception. So if we understand the word fact, you see, we don't understand the word fact in the right way. Fact, coming from facta, something created by the senses. People take fact to mean that which really is. But it is not really that way. It's just the way we see it. So all reductionism is an attempt to explain everything in the universe in terms of what we're seeing. So it is pratyakshavad, in other words. And it is very very primitive level of intellectual life, because even science itself is showing that there are levels of experience beyond what we see. So, and then in that book I've given the example of the spider sitting in the middle of its web. So the spider has very poor eyes, but can experience things very exactly through its web. It sits in the web, it's very sensitive to the vibrations of the web. The vibrations of the web, for the spider, is telling him something, you see? Like when we go on the internet, there's vibrations coming through the telephone wire, and then it appears on the computer screen as so much, you know, clear information. So this, we're talking about mystic powers. So the spider has some kind of mystic power like that. They can read the vibrations of its web and know exactly what's going on when some insect collides with the web. So, but this is the spider's own little world, you know. He's living in this web. And if the spider thinks the web is the universe, and everything that's happening in my web is all that is happening, then this is very primitive level of knowledge. And if we, you know, if we were able to somehow tap into spider's perceptions, what the spider thinks is going on, what the spider thinks is the universe, we as human beings would laugh. We would think, this is absurd. Or even if a fly comes into this room and lands on the wall, and if somehow we could interview the fly, "Mr. Fly, what is this place you're in?" And we would hear his description. We would laugh. We would think, this is crazy. You see? How a fly with his, you know, those big compound eyes and his antenna, how he would perceive this world, this room, and it would be very different because he has very different senses. So this is reductionism. The fly is asked, "What is this world?" And he gives an answer based on his sense perception. And then we who are on a different level of consciousness with different sense of senses, we hear that and we laugh and we say, this is absurd. Or to put it maybe a little more realistically, like when so-called advanced Western man goes to some village in darkest Africa and interviews the people there. What is the universe? You know, what is the world? And they tell him in terms of these foolish black savages think, you know, that everything has been created from a giant snake or something like that, swimming in a river. You know, so anyway, this is reductionism, that we try to reduce everything to our experience. Okay, yes? There's nobody else but you right now.
If you can say a few words about almost mystical neglection of Vedic wisdom in the West during the history and even now, because
mystical what?
Neglect.
Mystical, yeah. Neglect. I never heard that.
About because in a school they teach about Greek philosophers, they teach about Persian and Sumer culture, but no.
Nothing about India, yeah, isn't it? Yes. It is kind of mystical, isn't it? Well, this is all due to pride. The Europeans, people, because in Kali Yuga their culture has become very technologically advanced. And as I said, this goes hand in hand with the metaphysical aspect of science, that says everything reduces to mechanics. So the whole effort of science has been to reproduce what is happening in nature in machines. So birds are flying, so you make airplanes that fly. And they think this is progress. The more we can duplicate nature in our own machinery, the more advanced we are. So this has been going on now for some 300 years. or more even. So the European attitude is very puffed up, and India was one of those countries that was subjugated, colonized by European powers, by Great Britain. So this is shown, and there's a lot of historical evidence for this, that when Europeans in India began to discover that their own languages are traceable to roots that seem to, you know, end up in India. There's this, what they call the Indo-European family of languages. And the first Europeans who noticed this pattern, they came to a very simple and very reasonable conclusion that this means that actually our civilization must have started here in India. That, you know, our culture, our language, and there was one German scholar in the very beginning of the 1800s who proposed that the European people must have started in India, migrated out. And this is what Prabhupada said. But the Europeans wouldn't have that. You know, he was just one scholar who freshly discovered this information and came to that conclusion. But the Europeans who were in power, they really had to feel that our whole culture from the beginning was superior. So if everything comes from India, then how is it that we have, you know, we are dominating India? And they didn't like Indian culture. You know, they wanted to change it. They wanted to make it to Christian culture. So, therefore, this deliberate neglect, this leaving India out of history in the West, and all these crazy theories that it led to one of the most shameful periods of recent history. You know, this doctrine of the Aryan race. So, this also began back then, to explain the origin of the Aryan people. So the Indians obviously were some sort of branch of Aryan people, but the Europeans, they tried to move it. Rather than admitting that the source of the Aryan people was India, they moved it first to Iran, and then they moved it to Central Russia. That's where you get this Caucasian for white people. They're called Caucasian people because of the Caucasus Mountains. There's this idea that the white race started in... It's completely obsolete now, but the name stuck. Caucasian people. It's another thing about science. Things remain even after they've been disproved and become part of culture. And then they started to move it closer and closer to Europe, and finally the Germans said Germany is where the Aryans started, and then you got the whole, you know, Nazi movement and all of that. So it's just false ego. Yes, Martin?
Could you explain Scientology?
Scientology?
What is wrong with that?
This has nothing to do with science. Scientology is a cult that conceived of by a science fiction writer named L. Ron Hubbard. So he was a science fiction author who was involved in the 1940s in satanic experiments, attempts to summon up demons and things like that in California. And then somewhere along the line he stole some ideas from another science fiction author. Another, I don't know if anyway, some weird guy. We had some ideas about conditioning of consciousness by guilt, and it was some kind of psychology. Also very strange. And so this L. Ron Hubbard, because he was a science fiction writer, he could conceive of a whole like science fiction world with these principles that he stole from this other man. And that became the philosophy of Scientology. So, Scientology has nothing to do with science. It is a cult. I don't think they have this cult in India. You're fortunate.
We saw them in Los Angeles. And
yeah, yeah, they're put there. Just a bizarre group. Yes?
I was thinking about that we were explaining about evolution theory in terms of, you know, soul is traveling to different species. So, can you elaborate that? How is it actually working? In the sense that I heard that if you lose a human body, you have to go through 8 million 400 species. So, what is the basis in that? How can you categorize different animals? Is there some more problem?
Well, that's in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The categorization of the different forms of life is there. But ultimately, 8,400,000 species means 8,400,000 levels of consciousness. We do not actually define species in terms of simply body. This is a much more refined understanding of species according to consciousness. So that means, from Vedic point of view, there may be so many insects, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, because here's an insect with antenna going this way, and there's an insect with antenna going that way, that they must be two different species. They may have different types of antenna, but if they're, you know, their consciousness may be the same. So in that way, they might, from the Vedic point of view, it's the same species because mentality is the same. Yeah.
The consciousness is like a spectrum. So how 84 million and 84 lakhs species, it doesn't increase, it doesn't decrease, because it's like a spectrum. So why can't there be more species than that?
Because it's all within Brahma, Brahma's energy. Lord Brahma is the creator. So he's the most, in terms of consciousness, he is that jiva in this universe who is fully realized. So then his consciousness is establishing the limit of the whole system. So then, and this 8,400,000 is coming out of various combination of the gunas, starting with 3 and then multiplying. Finally, you get 8,400,000. So Brahma has arranged like that. And Brahma, all these 8,400,000, they are compact within Brahma's creative energy. But when Brahma creates, you know, there's this consideration of Brahma's, these great ages that come out of Brahma's time span, his days, his nights. And within these days and nights of Brahma, there are different periodical devastations. So living entities do appear and disappear, as we see on this earth. Some living entities are here. Some living entities that even in the Vedas are described are not visible now. What to speak of what, you know, they talk about dinosaurs and all these things, which Prabhupada said is all nonsense. But anyway, living entities that are indicated in the Vedas, which we would consider fantastic now, are no longer visible. So the manifestation of these living entities is according to time, but all of them, the forms, the seed forms, are within Brahma's own creative energy. You had a question?
Regarding this question, I just heard that these feminine and masculine type of species are also different species. Is it correct?
Male and female are different species?
Yes.
No. Out of 8,400,000? No. Yes?
The basic problem people believe on the sciences because the technology works, which comes directly to them.
Yes.
So they say, whatever the scientists say, they started believing.
Yes.
So how to make them believe?
Well, they have to become intelligent.
Because in the religion or things, when we say something, they put them to see things.
They have to become intelligent because the reason they're believing is because this technology facilitates their sense gratification, and sense gratification is making them stupid. So therefore they believe anything the scientists say because they're stupid. Scientists are making them stupid through the technology, and because they're stupid then they just... It's like a cow, you know, or like any lower animal. You feed it and then it becomes yours, you know. If you feed it, it will follow you. So all the people have become like that, like animals following the scientists. And Prabhupada gave very interesting analysis of science is this asura vidya, it's demoniac knowledge. He said that the scientists are, the whole program of science is to seduce women, actually, to make women more available, to ruin the morals of women, to make them more available for illicit sex. He gave a very interesting explanation of this. He said it's done by machines. That women, you know, in society, like we see in India, women work, they have their work they do, keeps them busy all day. Men have their work, which keeps them busy all day. And because they have to work all day, then at the end of the day they're tired, and then they don't have energy for illicit sex. And that's the natural arrangement of all society, you see, all, you know, traditional society, agrarian society, you know, society which is based on farming. You have to go out in the field and you have to work. If you want to eat, you know, then you have to go out and grow food. And it's only the more idle class, you know, a class of people who don't have so much to do. They might have that opportunity for illicit sex, but then in Vedic culture, the class that has less work to do are the more intelligent. So then by intelligence, they, you know, they're sense controlled, they're not, by their willpower, they're not going to engage in these forbidden activities. So what science does is it makes machines available so that women can do all their housework, you know, by pressing button on the washing machine and pressing a button on the stove, and you know, everything, all work is done in a couple hours. Men also, they just sit in an office all day or work some machine. So when they come home, then they have, you know, full energy to engage in sense gratification. And the production of newer and newer machines is creating an excitement in this society, which is Prabhupada explained, is this excitement is actually the excitement of lusty desire. Like all this, you know, new cars coming out every year. It's actually just a kind of agitation of the lust. Of course, you don't have that so much in India. You don't yet have not come to this point like in the West, where they announce the, you know, Chrysler for 2005, with big fanfare and showing the picture of the car. Then there's always a beautiful girl laying on the car. So this is all, you know, psychology, which is aimed at stimulating sex desire. And the machinery is making illicit sex more and more possible, more and more available. And you know, then coming to the thing about birth control, you know, this is also part of the same technology. And then in Japan, actually in Japan, they have really advanced in this more than anywhere else. They have in Japan these what they call love hotels, which are these places. It's just for having sex, and you rent a room. It's not really a room. It's just a place where a boy and girl can crawl into. There's not enough room to stand up because they're not going in there to stand up. But it's true. This is really true. It's a big thing in Japan. And it's some high-tech thing, you know. There's everything you need in there. Panel of buttons to press. You get something to drink, something to eat. Some little TV screen is there. And whatever you need to pass the time. And so, you know, so some boy and girl, they can meet on the street. Let's go to a love hotel. Okay. And go in there. And it's just for a little money, rent one cubicle, open the door, crawl inside, do their business and come out. Had a nice time. Yes. Okay. Goodbye. Well, what was your name? This is, you know, some really degraded scientific, you know, science fiction future. You already see it in Japan. At these love hotels, they look very, you know, they're very polished metal, you know, shining. They look like something very futuristic. And when inside, I've seen pictures of inside, it looks like inside of a spaceship, you know, the futuristic science fiction films, all these cubicles. You know. So Prabhupada actually said that it's just to facilitate sex life. And sex life makes people stupid. And makes them addicted. So therefore they surrender to these rascals. Yeah, you had a question?
I will translate.
Okay.
Hare Krishna, I chose and Madhavendra Puri from Brazil, Stilkan, Darwin, Theory of Professor Spindle, Bishop of the Bishop, not just a bit of Yavan's disturbing.
We just heard that Madhavendra Puri Prabhu just defeated the official Darwinian theories. So, do you know something about this in public? Is there any records or something?
It hasn't happened that way. Sorry. The scientific establishment is able to deflect. I mean, they're not only devotees, but they're getting challenged even from other scientists. They're getting serious challenge. But it's an institution, science. And Darwinism is still the official doctrine of the institution. So they have their method of just ignoring. There's so many very heavy and valid criticisms, but they just ignore it and go on with their business. So, anyway. Yes?
I just want to add something, because once I just spoke with one scientist, he's a professor from the university, and I just I just tried to prove some, you know, Krishna conscious, these evidences that life must come from life, you know, like this. So his answer, and usually the answers of the many professors were that, so if you that if you cannot, if you have, if you could not unprove our theories, so that they are valid still. So that means that if you don't have to offer something.
This is called in logic argumentum ad ignorantum,
yes.
An argument from ignorance. That yes, our theory may not explain everything, But there's nothing better. Unless you come with something better, then we will keep our theory. This is called argumentum ad ignorantum, and this is considered a logical fallacy. This is not considered a valid argument. But, you know, scientists, this is what was a point I made in the very beginning. A philosopher would be, you know, this would be a good argument for a philosopher. You know, what you're saying is argumentum ad ignorantum, and a philosopher might go, yeah, well, you're right there. And so let's discuss further. That's interesting. But scientists are not good philosophers. So they defend their theories with arguments that philosophically are not valid. And they don't even care. You make a mistake if you think a scientist should be like a philosopher. You know, a philosopher is more into just thinking and reasoning. And he may have his point of view, he may have his, you know, it may even be materialistic, but a philosopher is generally a person who's willing to discuss. You know, a philosopher, the nature of philosophy sort of puts everything up on the theoretical platform. That, all right, you know, we don't have to believe that it's only like this. We can think that it may be like that. Let's see what happens when we think it might be like that. Let's see if it's, you know, if we arrive at some better understanding. Philosophers are more willing, but not scientists. Because scientists are really, they're really just shudras. You know, they're really just glorified blacksmiths and carpenters. The word technology comes from Greek techne, which comes from Sanskrit taksha. So taksha is a word for the work of a carpenter. So technology is just fancy carpentry. That's all it is. And carpenter is a sudra. Like, that's why it was mentioned, Karna was rejected because his father was a carpenter. His father was a shudra. So built chariots. His father was a chariot builder. So a carpenter is just a shudra. So technology is just some shudra science. And that the scientist's brain is a shudra brain. So they don't have respect for, you know, for very careful logic. Because another thing about science, material science, is simply, you know, they're fascinated with the material energy. This is a type of religion, actually. Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out that the lowest level of religion, there are, you know, people like the Shaktas who worship Durga Devi, the primitives, when there's an earthquake or a volcano, then they bow down and they think a god has appeared. You see, a storm, they think the storm is a god. So these are worshippers of natural phenomena. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Srila Prabhupada both have categorized scientists in this class. This is the lowest class of religious understanding. It's totally primitive. So the scientists, they have this awe and fascination for material nature, the powers of material nature. So they see it in a somewhat mystical way. See, therefore, it doesn't have to follow your logic. It can be something, you know, very strange, very extraordinary, something that only we as scientists are qualified to really study. You have your you know, human way of thinking of things, your human language, but it may not account for what's really happening. This is like quantum physics, where they're studying subatomic particles. They always say like this, that what we're doing, it cannot even be explained in language, so never mind. So you can't understand quantum mechanics. So it has like a mystical aura around it, you know. And you see this also, these Shaktas, these tantrics, they're really the lowest grade of ignorance. And anyone can see that. They're really low-class people. But they think they're interested in the most mystical thing there is, you know. They think this is the real spiritual life. And we do things, we worship the goddess, and amazing things happen by her power, and everything is just power. Everything is just power. There's nothing else but Shakti, that's all there is. You see? And we know what this Shakti is. And the Vaishnavas don't know anything. They're worshipping their Vishnu deities, but they don't know that when Lord Ramachandra, when he wanted to cross to Lanka, he had to worship the goddess. He took an arrow and he dug out his own eye and worshipped it. Worshipped the goddess with his own eyeball. This is a Shakta story they tell. They have so many crazy stories like this. So Lord Ramachandra had to pull out his own eye with one of his arrows and offer it to the Devi. And then she gave him the power and she restored his eye. So by her grace, he was able to defeat Ravana. But when you look at these people, you know, in Indian society, everybody knows anyone who's into Tantra is just a low class, you know, nonsense. So in the same way, the scientists are on the same level. But in the West, they have risen to the top. You can imagine if in India, if some tantric would become prime minister or something.
This Arthur Clarke, the scientific writer, he just once said that, I think you just mentioned in your book, that the high-tech technology could be compared to the...
Yeah, he said any technology which is sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. So this is also, this is there in the scientists, their outlook of things. There's this magical element. You see, they're fascinated with material nature. So they really think that what's going on in nature, yes, it may not correspond to our human intellect. That's another reason why they don't care about philosophers. You're just dealing with words and your human ideas, but this is something, you know, very special, mystical, and only we can understand. And what we understand, it doesn't have to correspond with normal logic at all. So, you know, you can make your arguments, doesn't mean anything to us. Unless you have something better, we won't accept. Yes?
There were other categories talked by Bhaktivinoda, like Sauras and Ganapatis. Are they also projected in some particular like layers of people in modern world, like Shaktas project onto scientists?
Chaitanya Shikshamrita, so he starts with this level of primitives. And then he says there are those who, after having gone through that stage of researching material phenomena, they come to a conclusion that there must be something beyond, in some indeterminate realm beyond. They don't say what it is, they can't say what it is, but it's something beyond matter. So this is the impersonalists, for example, are like that. And some of the scientists come to that level, like the quantum physicists who say that beyond the physics is consciousness. But they have no further explanation of what consciousness is. And then beyond that is the demigod worshippers. And then beyond that are those who some philosophized super soul conception, some God who is appearing as a higher mind. And then the fifth stage is just is people who worship human beings, worship themselves, or worship the other human beings, gurus or political leaders or whoever, scientists, Albert Schweitzer, Mother Teresa. Okay, this is the last question.
You're saying that you're a scientist. You were saying that modern scientists, they're not ready to accept theories even if you prove it to them. That is, theories are proving some Vedic facts. So, but Prabhupada said it's very important to preach to the scientists. So, but if they won't accept it...
Yeah, but Prabhupada, therefore he appointed scientists to preach to scientists.
Yeah, so I was thinking, you said that the scientists are saying that if you give us something better, so it must be something better in their conception.
Yeah.
But
it's very hard going, because I've told you that science is it's an institution. And once German scientist Max Planck, he explained that science only changes its conceptions when former generation, which was believing those conceptions, when they all die off, then there's a new generation, and they may be more open to thinking of things differently. So we see now in the world such a change. People are generally more open to metaphysical conceptions beyond just gross matter. It's become quite a public thing. So, and also in recent times, there has been a trend, even it's seen among scientists, to go back to some form of, to adopt some form of religious idea. Many scientists do that. There's many books published by scientists. It may not be like a real pure theistic idea, but many scientists, after so much bafflement in this, in materialistic theories, have arrived that it makes sense that there would be a higher intelligence, a higher order to things. There's a Nobel Prize winning scientist, Fred Hoyle, and a Sri Lankan scientist, Chandra, some Sri Lankan name. They published a book in the 80s called The Intelligent Universe. And it's quite a good book, actually. It doesn't come really to the position of pure theism. It's more like pantheism, that somehow intelligence is somehow inherent in the universe. The universe itself is intelligent. They don't go as far as to say that there's a transcendent intelligence beyond the universe. But nonetheless, Fred Hoyle was a Nobel Prize winning, very serious scientist. He's dead now. So he came to this conclusion by his own, just observing what's going on in science and seeing that if we stick to purely materialistic theories, we can't explain anything. These theories are too primitive, they're too fantastic. And so science should actually explain something properly. So therefore we have to bring in intelligence. So he was giving very good arguments how life can't just arise spontaneously, how evolution just couldn't work mathematically. So his idea was that everything that happens in the universe is directed by some internal intelligence. And other scientists, there's one, Paul Davies, who's written a number of books. He takes the same position. Then I have another book. I think also Paul Davies may be a co-author. I have a book on my computer called The Matter Myth. This is also a very recent book. So they're saying matter itself is just a big myth, that the only thing there is consciousness, actually. This is a pretty good conclusion. And matter is just a way of perceiving consciousness. And so they're arguing this, giving so many recent scientific discoveries. So anyway, we see in recent trends in science that there's this openness more to spiritual ideas. So, of course, there's still a lot of hardcore materialistic scientists left. And the establishment science still tends to be atheistic and materialistic. But I think with the change of generations that will also change. So devotees should just keep preaching, because by preaching and by distributing books, particular to students in universities, the average devotee may not be able to preach to a scientist, but you can preach to someone who can become a scientist later on. And if you put something in his head, that like a seed, then that can stay even as he's becoming a scientist. And then their whole conception of scientists of science will change. All right, so this is enough. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.